This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So perhaps the Kremlin will just force this local commanders of Wagner divisions to move along with their subordinates under the leadership of other private military companies.
That was VOA's Danila Galaprovich on what might happen next with Russia's Wagner's mercenaries. Details coming up. Also, voting was extended after delays hit Zimbabwe's elections. And BRICS invites Ethiopia and Egypt, along with four other countries, to join. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The reported death of Wagner Group chief Yevgeny Prigozhin in an airplane crash has once again put the spotlight on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin's presumed death could have significant ramifications for the future of the Wagner Group of mercenaries and Russian foreign policy in regions such as Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. For a better understanding on the matter, I first asked Voice of America Russian service reporter Danila Galaprovich, who is closely monitoring the story, to talk to us about the crash and the passengers.
What we can say now is that Russian official departments, Russian officials were very quick to inform the public about Prigozhin and his close allies being on the board of this plane which crashed over Russia. And Federal Air Transport Agency, for example, almost immediately published a list of passengers, as you said, and it was including Prigozhin. Many media started to try to confirm his death with people associated with him, and death of Prigozhin was actually confirmed in social medias, but which are connected to Wagner Group, like Gray Zone Telegram channel. And according to several journalists in Russia, employees of Prigozhin's structures began to be notified about the death of the boss.
Many blame Putin and other Russian officials for orchestrating his death and are threatening retaliatory action against Moscow. Social media channels linked to the Wagner alleged that Russia air defenses shot down the plane.
We cannot say if there is any truth in that or not, but we can definitely confirm that allies of Prigozhin are very angry. And I noticed in one of Telegram channels that the group associated with Prigozhin and part of the Wagner Group mercenaries, so they said that this death of Prigozhin was arranged by the traitors of Russia. They threatened about the new mutiny and new march to Moscow. So many experts say that despite that Putin may show to the Russian elite that he was not afraid of this attempt of coup d'etat or mutiny 2 months ago. In the public opinion, and especially in ultra-patriots, Putin played rather badly, and probably he undermined his image amongst those who supports his campaign in Ukraine.
So what comes next? How might Wagner change? Will the Kremlin likely seize control of Russia's Wagner mercenary company?
A lot of experts are saying now that operation of the Wagner Group in Africa, for example, as well as in Syria and in other places, will not stop after the death of Prigozhin and his subordinates who was on a plane. I just remind our listeners that there were more 6 people from Wagner Group at that board, including Dmitry Utkin, who gave the name Wagner because he had a nickname Wagner, and that's how Wagner Group was named after Mr. Utkin.
So the second in command, right?
Yes, he was a second in command, but there were many others, including one of them who was operating in Sudan, for example. So experts with whom I spoke almost immediately after the news, Kimberly Martin from Barnard College, she said that in Africa, the Wagner units in each of the countries where they operate are under command of separate commanders. So perhaps the Kremlin will just force these local commanders of Wagner divisions to move along with their subordinates under the leadership of other private military companies, for example, Company Redoute, which was organized also in Africa and in Syria, because Kremlin would like to continue to receive incomes from operations initiated by Yevgeny Prigozhin in Africa, but without the problems that he himself created for Kremlin.
That was Voice of America Russian Service reporter Danila Galaprovich. Voting stretched into today in Zimbabwe, where delays in distributing ballot papers forced the country's president to extend the election day at dozens of polling places. For more on the situation, I talked to reporter Kudza Zanwashi in Harare.
Yes, voting is still going on in some of the polling stations. So yesterday, the president had to issue a statutory instrument instructing that there will be an extension in the voting period. So you find that yesterday, some people had to vote under the cover of darkness. Some polling stations only started serving people as late as 7 p.m., some at 9 p.m., some even started serving people today. So that's the situation that we have on the ground regarding voting.
Zimbabwe has a history of, violent and disputed elections. And Mnangagwa just claimed Zimbabwe to be a master of democracy, criticizing Western countries that expressed concern about the credibility of the polls a few weeks ago. And his main challenger, Nelson Chamisa, is describing the election as a sham, claiming that the voting delays were aimed at disfranchising voters in his urban strongholds. What do you hear about that?
Yes, so Chamisa maintains that this election has been a sham, even though they are recording victories. So some results have started coming in, and both parties are making gains. You find that some of the highly contested seats, there's news filtering in that the opposition has won. But this has always been the trend with election results, particularly urban areas. Results from urban areas usually are the first that start trickling in, and they give an impression that the opposition is going for a landslide victory. And then the rug is pulled under their feet when results from rural areas start also coming in. So we're yet to see where it goes, but the position of the main opposition is that this election is a sham, but this has not dampened their spirits. This has not stopped them from celebrating the victories that are coming in.
Kudzai, what does the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission say about all this?
So in regards to the delays, they are linking this to the court cases that were ongoing in the build-up to this, from the nomination court period building up to the voting time, to the voting period. So they are linking this delay to that, to say we couldn't vote before the courts made a decision on who goes on the ballot paper, because there were a lot of contestations regarding, there were a lot of court cases about people filing court papers late, therefore they were not eligible to contest. Some people were contesting the aspect that they had the local currency and tried to pay, but there were delays in that regard. So there were a lot of these court cases. So that's what they are linking this delay to. But you find that in Kwazana, where Charlton Wende, one of the main opposition's member of parliamentary candidates, he said the ballot papers for his constituency, he was notified yesterday that they were being printed yesterday. So that's where the delay was. So you find that there are also reports that some of these ballot papers were literally printed yesterday on election day.
And the day after, Kudzai, what is the general mood?
Well, the mood now is a bit, I think there is a bit of mixed feelings. So the messaging from the opposition is that people should stay vigilant, people should be patient and still vote, because they feel like there's a tactic to discourage the urban population, which is their stronghold. And you find that people in urban areas do not have time to stand around and wait for many hours to cast a ballot paper. They would want to go about their lives and go and take care of their families and go on about their lives. This is unfamiliar territory for anyone in Zimbabwe. We have never been in this part. We've never had such a delay before. So it's these are uncharted waters.
That was reporter Kudzai Zenwashi in Harare. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Wednesday night in the U.S., eight of the Republican Party presidential candidates clashed on the debate stage. It was the first political debate ahead of the 2024 presidential election, and notably the leading candidate, former President Donald Trump, was not there. VOA senior national correspondent Steve Herman was at the debate in the Midwestern city of Milwaukee, and he joins me now by phone to fill us in. Welcome to African News Tonight, Steve.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. We just ended about 12 hours ago the debate here in the state of Wisconsin.
So, Steve, describe to our African audience the significance of debates before elections in America and talk to us about some of the key takeaways from yesterday's debate.
Well, as you know, we have Donald Trump again trying to get his old job back in 2024. And hoping for a rematch with the presumptive Democratic Party nominee, the incumbent Joe Biden. Trump was not on the stage last night, but we had eight other candidates who want to also be president. So this was really the big kickoff for the 2024 election cycle with this two-hour televised debate on Fox News, with the moderator saying early on that they wanted to talk about the elephant who is not in the room, which was Donald Trump. And the candidates did talk a lot about Donald Trump.
So the candidates had sparred over a variety of issues, ranging from abortion and the economy to Ukraine and education. Did anybody make good points?
Yeah, there were some very spirited discussions on these issues. And we saw, especially on some aspects of foreign policy, that clear differences emerged between some of the candidates when we're talking about Ukraine. For example, we had the former governor of South Carolina, who had also been an ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, who was very supportive of Ukraine, while another ethnic Indian politician, a novice, Vivek Ramaswamy from the state of Ohio, who's been rising in the polls, he was much more skeptical of U.S. support to Ukraine, saying that China is actually the bigger threat to the United States than Russia.
And the eight Republicans were asked whether they would support Trump as the party's nominee, even if he was convicted of a crime. All but two said they would. Could you
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two who were in the minority camp were the former governor of the state of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, who is in single digits in the polls, and then also a former friend of Donald Trump, the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, who seems to be in this race solely as a flamethrower to say that Trump should not be president again. He violated the Constitution, and he's not qualified to be president ever again.
And finally, let's talk about the elephant not in the room, Mr. Trump, turning himself in at the Fulton County Jail in the state of Georgia, where he has been charged with criminal activity because of his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss. How is that expected to play out?
Yeah, we're just hours away from that occurring at the Fulton County Jail, where Trump will surrender. He is now facing four serious criminal cases, in all 91 felony counts against him for criminal acts allegedly committed before, during, and after his presidency.
VOA senior national correspondent Steve Herman, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Leaders of the BRICS countries at a summit in Johannesburg have announced that six new members will join the bloc in January. The other additional states are Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. Current BRICS members are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
China, Russia, and South Africa say they want BRICS to counterbalance the West. Some analysts say the inclusions of Iran and major oil exporter Saudi Arabia in particular is a powerful message that BRICS intends to rival organizations such as the G7 and G20. The BRICS countries say these groupings and institutions such as the United Nations and World Bank are pro-West and do not represent the interests of the global South. China's President Xi Jinping called the BRICS expansion historic.
It shows the determination of BRICS countries for unity and cooperation with the broader developing countries. It meets the expectation of the international community and the common interests of emerging market countries and developing countries. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism, further strengthen the force for world peace and development.
Brazil's leader Lula da Silva said BRICS now represents 46% of the global population and 37% of the world GDP. A South African official at the summit told VOA the push for expansion was driven overwhelmingly by China, supported strongly by Russia and South Africa. He said India and Brazil were hesitant to add some of the prospective new members, concerned that China and Russia want to use BRICS to fight the United States and its allies. But he added, Brazil's Da Silva and India's Narendra Modi eventually agreed to expansion after receiving assurances that a bigger BRICS would develop poorer nations rather than be weaponized. Political analyst Moletsi Mbeki says the tension between China and India in particular was clear at the summit.
India has become closer to the Western powers, I think, as a result of its disputes with China. So it's driving India into the arms of the West. For the BRICS group, this is a problem. But for India, given the threat, China is a much bigger military power than India. India has to turn to the West for help in its border dispute with China. And India is turning more and more to the Western countries for military equipment. It's turning to the United States, it's turning to France. Traditionally, India has been armed by Russia, but Russia and China have become close as a result of the war in Ukraine. So India appears to be backing off from its relationship with Russia.
For decades, both India and China have disputed the border of the world's two most populated countries. There have been several deadly clashes in recent years between their troops. Russia has become increasingly isolated by international sanctions since it invaded Ukraine last year. At the same time, China has said the United States is trying to start a new Cold War as it seeks to balance Beijing's territorial moves in Asia and to reduce U.S. dependence on supply chains in China. Mbeki thinks BRICS felt forced to add new members fast.
I suspect one of the drivers of that, of course, has been the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia by the Western powers and the arming of Ukraine against the Russian Federation. Generally, I think there's a bigger consensus within the BRICS member countries about how they see the new world order, what it should look like. They are certainly against domination by the Western powers.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa says BRICS will expand more in the future. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
More than 200,000 refugees fleeing Sudan's civil war have arrived in the town of Adre, Chad, since the middle of June. Before the crisis, the town had a recorded population of just 40,000. In this report, Henry Wilkin asks Adre residents and newly arrived refugees what they are going to do to help the vast influx of new residents.
Hagan Ali Zorgan is a humanitarian activist and resident of Adre, a town in Chad across the border from Sudan's chronically troubled Darfur region. More than 200,000 Sudanese refugees have arrived in the town in recent weeks, fleeing fighting in Darfur and attacks against civilians. They've built makeshift shelters in the countryside that surrounds Adre, as far as the eye can see. Zorgan says from a humanitarian perspective, people can't be left to suffer like this. They're very tired and sick. The latest arrivals were stuck in Janina, a town in West Darfur, for 3 months, he says. And some residents of Adre have volunteered to help cook for refugees, bringing flour and sugar. That's humanitarian, he says. There are people, and we care about them. Zorgan has started a TikTok channel to raise awareness about the refugees' plight. He interviews them and documents local efforts to help them. His channel has attracted tens of thousands of views. Residents of the towns hosting the refugees, as well as refugees themselves, have been playing a vital role in assisting those in need, complementing the international response. Nonetheless, the suffering of the refugees in Adre is great. Salima Abdallah Idris Ishak has just arrived carrying all of her possessions. She says ethnic Arab militia groups attacked civilians and pushed them out of Sudan. She says the militia groups told her family their home no longer belongs to them. They said the country belongs to the militias and her family don't have the right to anything in it. Some refugees have lent their skills to helping those like Ishak, who are newly displaced by the conflict. Dr. Mohamed Mustafa fled the Sudanese city of Janina, which has been ripped apart by the war 2 months ago. He now volunteers at this medical centre that non-profits set up in the Adre camp.
Since I am one of the refugees, so I see the pain of the people. We mainly targeted the women and the children because they are the most vulnerable. We have a small clinic and we have a small laboratory for minor investigation. And we have minor operation room for the wounds and cleaning and stuff. And we have a pharmacy.
The top official in Adre says helping refugees is part of the fabric of the town. It previously welcomed refugees from the Darfur War that began in 2003. Kunal Ali Mohamed Sebi says refugees have been living with us for 20 years now, and they have the same rights and are equal to us. They've benefited from non-profits here, providing health and education. Thousands more refugees are expected to arrive in Adre in the coming weeks and months, as the war in Sudan drags on. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
And in more news from Sudan, Sudan's Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan was seen today outside his headquarters in Khartoum for the first time since fighting erupted more than 4 months ago with paramilitaries. International news media report army videos filmed before dawn and posted on the army's Facebook page showed Burhan speaking to soldiers with the caption indicating that he was at the Wadi Sidna air base north of Khartoum. News agencies could not verify the footage or images. The army has been battling the paramilitary rapid support forces since April. Thousands of troops and civilians have been killed and millions of civilians have been displaced. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Adrias Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.